He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31.
Our next person to interview is Colonel Joe Schweitzer. 1983 to 2006, he was an officer in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He was command of soldiers at the company, battalion, and brigade level to include in combat. Other assignments he had included assistant professor at the United States Military Academy, a NATO plan officer during combat operations in Kosovo, and he was also a maneuver support center chief of operations in headquarters, USACE, colonel retired. And I met Joe this last year, and he agreed to do these interviews. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse again, and we are back for another interview with Joe Schweitzer. I really like Colonel Joe. I have a friend named Colonel Joe. That makes me sound pretty cool. But Joe has been, how many years were you in the military, Joe?
I served 23 years in our Army.
Wow. And have certainly been after that, you know, of course, with your businesses and things, you've certainly been associated in a lot of those same type of things. But in this episode, we'd like to talk a little bit about how war evolves and the sophistication of weapons. You know, you talk about the Mikluk and things that we just were non-existent. Someone said to me, if we had had drones on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, we would certainly have addressed that in a much different way. So what are some of the major kinds of advancements, I guess that's it? And certainly with a lot of the development of weaponry, we've also made a lot of advancements in other areas, too. That just happens naturally. So what do you think are some of the major advancements that we have now in warfare that were developed through that Desert Storm era?
So in the last episode, we talked about the evolution of our doctrine and the air-land battle doctrine, which allows you to reach out and touch your enemy before he's able to touch you in both space and time. And, you know, along with that, in the 80s, mid to late 80s, before Desert Storm, our Army underwent modernization. There were the introduction of several advanced weapon systems. And so, you know, one was the Patriot missile system to protect from things like Scuds, and the Patriot missile system and the Israeli Iron Dome are a very formidable defensive system to protect you from very large and long-range missiles. And so we had the Patriot, we had the Apache helicopter, still in use today, very heavily used in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's an attack helicopter, Hellfire missiles, 30-millimeter chain gun, I think, or 25-millimeter chain gun under its nose. The Black Hawk, a troop carrier, medical evacuation, the Black Hawk helicopter, the Abrams tank. We're on our third or fourth generation of that today, a very lethal, a very, very capable weapon system. I think we had the original Abrams that we were using, you know, the first generation that we used in our armored task force. And then the Bradley fighting vehicle, an infantry vehicle with TOW missile system and some variants, and again, a 25 or 30 millimeter chain gun Bushmaster. And so we fielded those in the mid to late 80s. I remember I got the Humvee, soft skin, you know, the next generation of the Jeep. I turned in my World War II Willie type Jeep and got the Humvee. It was also a part of that modernization. And then we trained with it. We trained with it in our combat training centers, the National Training Center out in California, the Joint Readiness Training Center in Louisiana, and the Combined Maneuver Training Center in Germany, Grafenwehr, Germany. And we trained. We trained with, you know, basically laser tag miles systems that replicated, you know, the range. You had a laser on your M1 tank, and all the vehicles had laser detection on them. So, and the range of that laser was basically the range of the weapon system of that tank. And so we had force-on-force training, training with all these new, you know, weapon systems. And then we brought them to bear, and it's one of the reasons, the combination of our doctrine and the combination of our modernization effort, and fighting an enemy like the one, although the environment was very different than the European environment. In fact, all of our vehicles, they weren't painted tan, all of our vehicles in our task force. Many of my pieces of equipment still had, you know, the camouflage pattern. We wore our uniform. We didn't get our chocolate chip desert uniform until we were getting ready to get on the plane going home. We wore our, you know, the woodland battle dress uniform of Europe. Wow. But we fought an enemy that was equipped with Soviet weapon systems and fought with Soviet doctrine. And that's what we had been training throughout the Cold War. And I think, you know, all those pieces colliding on the desert floor meant the rapid and quick destruction of the Iraqi forces.
Does that have the fact that within the Cold War era, that you were actually, you know, very much aware of Russian forces and how the Russian army was conducting themselves. Does that have an advantage for us right now, or at least a positive thing in dealing with Russia in Ukraine? I mean, do we know how they think in some respects?
So my take, and this goes now lifting out, you know, and projecting, you know, how warfare has evolved, you know, since Desert Storm to what we're seeing today. You know, since Desert Storm, we spent 20 years in Afghanistan and Iraq, and we fought a totally different kind of warfare. We used a lot of the same weapon systems, but our doctrine had to change very quickly, because the nature of the conflict wasn't, you know, tank-on-tank battles. We were now fighting in urbanized terrain. We were fighting in cities. And we were fighting amongst civilian populations that, you know, we had to protect. And so, you know, whereas in Desert Storm, we were able to reach out with our, you know, rocket systems 120 kilometers, in Iraq and Afghanistan, we were fighting, you know, in the cities of Iraq, we were fighting 25 meters out. There was no depth. There was no, you know, it was man on man, and it was, you know, soldier on soldier, and it was, you know, clearing houses, clearing rooms, you know, very close night fights. And we did that, you know, for 20 years. A lot of our armor task forces, our armor, you know, wasn't the capability. And so we took, you know, wasn't the tool that was always need it in every situation. So a lot of our armor soldiers got off their tanks and learned how to patrol the streets of Iraq and Afghanistan. The nature changed very differently. And then now what we're seeing in Ukraine, it may have started off, like with the Russian invasion, it may have started off very, you know, back to the Cold War era, that kind of combat operation. You know, again, tank on tank, armor vehicle on armor vehicle, maneuver warfare. But, you know, very quickly, it didn't work for the Russians. And the Russians were grounded, you know, they no longer, in both cases, Ukraine and Russia, they're no longer able to maneuver, ground maneuver. And now we're seeing a style of warfare that looks a lot like World War One. You know, they're entrenchment, they're entrenched, we're on linear positions, because no one has control of the air, and not having control of the air has prevented ground maneuver to take place safely. And now we're using things like drone warfare, and I mean not the big drone systems that we use born out of the CIA, you know, the large scale platforms.
Right.
We're talking individual store bought drones operated by a Ukrainian soldier, you know, and he's put a mortar round on the bottom of it, and he releases the mortar round inside the turret of a Russian tank, and they're totally vulnerable the way they have the munitions in their tanks. They're not, our M1 is designed, the munitions are separated from the crew compartment, and they're designed in the event that they do detonate, they explode upward and away from the crew department, whereas in a Russian tank, the munitions are around the turret, inside the turret of the tank. And so one little mortar round, one hand grenade, can sympathetically detonate the, you know, the 120 millimeter tank round inside, and you see them popping, like the tank turrets popping like bottle caps.
Well, it's now one quick question. You know, one of the things you were talking about that your group was given the task of destroying all these tanks and vehicles that were left behind by the Iraq soldiers. Are those just chunks of metal still laying out there in the desert someplace?
Well, we had so much equipment to destroy, and we carried all of this heavy explosives, whether they be mines or Miklik charges, C4, TNT, we carried all of this with us, your basic load, and we didn't employ almost any of them during those 100 hours of ground combat operations. And we had such a high volume of equipment, you know, we were going after and looking at ways of completely destroying the tank. And then, because we were afraid of running out of explosives and having too much equipment to destroy it, kind of became a competition. Soldiers, and again, soldiers are creative as heck. It became a competition of how do you render this piece of equipment useless with the minimal amount of explosives. So we'd have a artillery piece, a towed artillery piece, a large cannon, basically. And, you know, a soldier, we learned that you could take a quarter stick of C4 explosives and put it in the breech block of the artillery piece and explode it and render it completely useless. So the gun tube is still there, the wheels are there, the towed yokes are there, but if you look closely, the breech block doesn't work and won't work unless it's replaced. And so, you know, that's how style tank, the T-54s, 62s, 72s, was very easy just to let their ordnance do the heavy work, and we'd stick a grenade in the bustle rack or a stick a C-4 in the bustle rack and let their munitions completely destroy the tank.
So the tank, you could no longer go down to AutoZone and say, I need a couple parts for an Iraqi tank and just put it back together very easily. So
Yeah, the turret of the tank would be, 25 meters away from the rest of the body of the tank. So,
Wow.
More than the AutoZone.
Wow. I have a question here, too, that has to do it seems to me kind of what's happened in the war in Gaza is the same type of thing, whereas Israel went in with a hellacious air strike, bombardment, blowing just thousands of buildings up. And now to really get the work done, it's pretty much, like you said, on the ground, Marines, soldiers going in. I guess they're not Marines, but I mean, they're military personnel going in ground to ground and clearing houses and clearing buildings. And I guess there's literally miles and miles of tunnels that have to be cleared. It seems it's a different environment, but it's kind of the same approach, correct?
So, Gaza, there's some similarities in the way war is being waged in Gaza than, similar to perhaps Iraq. Gaza is heavily, heavily populated, very dense, and the resounding majority of them are innocent. And Hamas has deliberately used the people of Gaza as a shield to allow them to maneuver and wage war. And as a result of that, there has been, the Israeli Defense Forces have killed a lot of innocents. I've lost track of the number, but it grows, every day. So the nature of the warfare is, house to house clearing, tunnel warfare, something, my dad did in Vietnam and some of your friends have done in Vietnam,
Yes.
That the idea, the Hamas is, the labyrinth of tunnels that they've created to allow them to maneuver undetected and protected, from one hospital to another or a hospital to a mosque, where they operate.
And so
it's been, a very, very difficult, but there's no real way to win and create a secure environment easily when Hamas is fighting this way. And as a result, Israel has created the conditions. I don't think, given the way we're waging war, and this is just my personal opinion, unless there's a two-state solution at the end of Gaza, I think Israel will not be a secure country in the future. I think killing of all of these innocents, whether brought upon by Hamas or not, all you've done is created the next generation of enemy, their children.
I could not agree more.
Hamas, they're the ones that perpetrated this. They're the ones that caused this. I think Israel has the right to protect themselves and defend their country. But unless something's got to change very, very quickly, and again, my opinion, it's got to be a two-state solution, and we've got to stop with the killing of these innocents. And how to do that, given the way Hamas is fighting, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I do know that it threatens the long-term security of Israel. And whatever objectives they're trying to achieve in this, long-term peace will not be obtained given the way this is playing out.
And I know with even some of my, two of my friends from my high school were what they called, the tunnel rats in Vietnam. And I, first of all, somebody who doesn't really like enclosed spaces, that would not be my choice of jobs in the military. But it was just amazing, the tunnels in Kuchi, where you can actually go back now, and several of them have, as a citizen, and take a tour of these tunnels. And in the Oshaw Valley, which was one of the big battles in Vietnam, they had literally thousands of people underground that just kind of popped up and were well-armed. And, they mentioned there their hospitals underground and their ways that they did, brought fresh air in and had escape hatches. And just amazing. And I can't imagine, and with the technology now, like in Gaza, building those tunnels, they said some you could drive, a small vehicle through. And,
yes.
You know.
So my dad, he fought in Kuchi, 1st Infantry Division, the Iron Triangle region of Vietnam. And him and his soldiers typically would fight in a tunnel armed with a flashlight and their .45 caliber pistol. And you would, defeat whatever NI personnel devices were there. You did all of that with hand. And the fighting in Gaza right now, the evolution of the tools of warfare that the IDF is using, they're using artificial intelligence to figure out, an article I read in the Washington Post not too long ago, they identified 36,000 targets using AI. Even the whole notion of AI, is very new, and so that's being applied to warfare. But yeah, the tunnels and the tools to defeat them, fighting in tunnel warfare, has gotten very sophisticated.
And
but the nature of it is much the same. The tools may be different. The tactics, though, and the the use of the tools and the tactics have evolved.
Yeah. And where do you see things going in the future? Do you think it's? I mean, we've got nuclear weapons. Korea's got nuclear weapons. I'm not sure which other. I know Russia, does. I'm not sure how many countries actually have capability of nuclear weapons and getting them sent someplace, but. That seems just, the last time we really used nuclear weapons, anybody, was, of course, during, the end of World War II in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I just don't see that as a viable way to go unless a country just does not care at all. What is your opinion?
Nuclear weapons, when you're dealing with nations, the greatest deterrent to the use of nuclear weapons is our triad. We're air base, sea base, and land base. And, Russia, China, the major states, the major countries, they know that if they were to employ nuclear weapons, it would be to assure their destruction, as well as ours. It would,
sure.
And that's what has prevented the use of nuclear weapons. Now, not every, the big fear is a non-state actor, terrorist organization, you know, getting a hold of a nuclear weapon where they really don't care. You know, there is no state, there is no, the assured destruction is either the destruction of their, you know, their young, you know, their soldiers, their foot soldiers, because many of the leadership are fighting in these non-state actors. They're cowards, in my book.
Yeah.
But, you know, so the big fear there is the use, and then, but, you know, the location from where they use them from, if they were to get a hold of radiological material and create a dirty bomb.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Radiological debris rather than, you know, having the sophistication and the ability to launch something.
Right.
You know, and then how do we retaliate against that? You know, they you know, set off a device, a dirty bomb in the D.C. metro system, and, you know, it, whether it be Hamas or whether it be, you know, some version of ISIS, how do we, you know, we can continue to go after their leadership, something we're still doing, but they don't stand in large formations. They don't have a country. They don't have something that we could retaliate. So, you know, the nature of that warfare, I think there's at least two paths, and one is state actors, and that's, you know, it's highly unlikely that we'll use nuclear devices in that scenario, but the dirty bomb scenario against terrorist organizations is a real threat, and a threat of today and time to come.
And you and I have both been back to D.C. many times, and I'm sure you've been in the metro system in D.C. and the underground system there, and I mean, that's just ripe for that type of attack. And when you've got the literally thousands of people that use that system effectively to get to work every day, it's pretty scary. No, it doesn't.
Yes. No, it's a real threat. And, you know, we have both military and other governmental organizations that are working hard with tools and techniques to counter that real threat every day. But it's, you know, how do you protect mass transit public systems, you know, that you want hundreds of thousands of people to use on any given day? How do you defeat the one wolf in the crowd of lambs that looks exactly like the lamb? And, you know, so it's a real threat.
It's you know, I think the tough part is, you know, we need to give people rights and the ability to do things, but we certainly don't want our high schools and our libraries and everything appear to be, you know, encampments of, you know, where you've got to, you can't move without anything. And so in closing this episode, let's just say that, you know, the ultimate would be to have no more war and to have people at peace. That's probably not going to happen, but let's just keep our thoughts and minds and prayers that minimum damage to, and hope these wars in Ukraine and Gaza are solved and we can get them past us and work together. And so with that, I'm going to close this episode. And thank you, Colonel Joe, my friend. I'm just really liking that. So anyhow, you take care. And we'll talk to you afterwards, Joe. And we're going to close. Take a stand.